So first, still time at the break. If you want to get tickets to Banduras Talk tonight, I feel a little bit dirty flogging this, but Psych Office has got tickets. They're $10 for students. We'll be over at the TELUS Center tonight talking about some stuff. Could come as a Bobo doll, you know, really freak him out. Okay. Anyways, chapter the ninth, extinction of conditioned behavior. A lot's actually been happening in terms of research going on. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Pardon me? You're right. We didn't finish chapter eight. But I'm so excited about extinction that I have to start here. You're quite correct. Well, why don't I just rectify that little error on my part? Thank you. And we'll come back to extinction. Let's see, we did that, and we did this, and we did that, and this, and we're here. Yes? All right. Okay. So, thank you. Back to eight. Okay, so context cues. We've seen examples already of where context cues can exert stimulus control over behavior, perform a response, an appropriate response in a given context, not in others. Siegel's classic studies with morphine tolerance. So we've got Siegel did his early work on this with rats. It was a home room and an injection room. Rats would be taken from their home room down the hall to the injection room. The rooms looked different. They were decorated in different ways. And in the injection room, they would get an injection of morphine. And they'd be put on a little hot plate. And Siegel would wait to see how long it took before the rats started doing a little dance, lifting their feet off the hot plate. And over 4 days, even though they'd gotten the same amount of morphine, the rats developed some tolerance. Now, what he found was that if he took the rats and instead of giving them their injection in the home room, he instead shot them up with morphine and bopped them on a hot plate in their home room, where they'd never gotten an injection of morphine before, the tolerance disappeared. In other words, the home room did not have the right context, so the home room did not serve as a CS for the indication that the morphine was going to be delivered. So a conditional compensatory response, that is something that caused the rat's body to prepare for the coming morphine, was linked specifically to the contextual stimuli of the injection room, the injection site. So, nice example of context cues there. Perkins and Wyant in 58 had done something else with context cues. They ran two groups of rats through an identical maze. The turns, the twists, the paths that you would have to follow to get through the maze were exactly the same. The only difference was that one maze was painted white and the other maze was painted black. So half the rats were run through the white maze, half the rats were run through the black maze, and then half of each group was tested in its original maze, and the half was tested in the maze of the opposite color. Those rats that were tested in the maze of the opposite color did pretty terribly. It's like, it's a completely new maze. I have no idea where I am. Where should I go? I'm so confused. Does anybody have the GPS? No, not in 58. So, just the context, just the color. It's the same maze, same turns. It wasn't really a complicated maze. It was like a bizarrely tricky or difficult. It just, from the rat's point of view, it's like, whoa, this is someplace totally different. I got to learn this all over again. Curse you, psychologists. Curse you, Perkins and Wyant, for confusing us. Okay, so in that case there, we've got another contextual. And from a human's point of view, right, from your godlike perspective of 5'10", being able to look down on the table with the maze on, it's like, dudes, little rodent dudes, it's the same maze. Well, yeah, it's just one's white, one's black. But from the rat's point of view, that's apparently pretty important because I guess from their perspective, that's sort of what they see more. It's like, oh, yeah, different color. Got to be a different place. Kamen in 57 did a lovely little study looking at state-dependent learning. In this case, it was rats doing avoidance learning. So he trains them up on avoidance learning, and then he just lets them go through a forgetting process. So he delays. And then every 6 hours, he tests them to see how their performance does. So this is kind of like an Ebbinghaus kind of forgetting curve sort of thing. So after 6 hours, they're only avoiding about 65% of the time. After 12 hours, less than 50. After 18 hours, about 38% success on avoidance. But oh my gosh, what happens here? 24 hours, they're back up to about 58, 60% success. Maybe it was just an anomaly. Oh yeah, okay. 30 hours, they're doing worse. 36, 42. But oh wait, 48 hours, they're doing better again. What's happening here is every 24 hours after they'd finished the learning phase, physiologically the rats are back in the same physiological state. Right? They're on the same day-night cycle, the same wake-sleep cycle. They get fed at regular periods. So their bodies, their little rats here, are on pretty regulated schedule. And physiologically speaking, there's internal cues. So their own internal bodily state, their own physiology, that some parts of their nervous system are monitoring for homeostatic purposes or whatnot, goes, yep, this is, 24 hours later, we're back in exactly the same state. And some part of the brain has processed that and went, yeah, we were learning how to avoid when we felt exactly this hungry and were exactly this sleepy and had been awake this long, whatever it happens to be. And that gives them the cue. It's like, oh, yeah, that's what I'm supposed to be doing in here. I'm supposed to be making an avoidance response. Yeah, I kind of forgot about that, but this is reminding me. Okay? Or, more correctly, the contextual cues exert stimulus control. So the context cue becomes, once you get back into the same physiological state, stimulus control is exerted again. Atkins, in 85, worked with quails and looked at male quail sexual conditioning. Had an arena, two compartments. One had a sand-covered floor with orange walls. The second one had a wire mesh floor, wire mesh walls, and a green ceiling. So pretty different compartments there. The individual male quails were allowed to walk back and forth between the two compartments for their baseline preferences. And the quails, would prefer one compartment over the other. Different quails seem to like orange ceilings and sand floor. Others like wire mesh. It gives my feet something to grip onto. Who knows? And a green ceiling. So there is different preferences there. The less preferred compartment, they turned into, they said, we're going to treat that as the CS. So each quail would have a less preferred compartment. That became the CS plus. And then they went through a conditioning phase where they associated that compartment with a sexually receptive female quail. That's the US. So that compartment becomes an excitatory conditional stimulus for access to a female quail. The control group is only presented with the female quail in their home cage, never in the arena, so never in the CS plus compartment there. And this is what we find over three preference tests: the percentage of time spent in your CS compartment goes way up in the experimental group, but not in the control. Okay, statistically, for the controls, there's no difference between the three preference tests there. Big difference between these here. So after just a very short time, the quails that had been exposed to the female quail in the less preferred compartment will be spending their time in the less familiar or the less preferred compartment. It's like, this is where I go to meet the sexy female quail. The context cues. Okay. I could probably extrapolate to something about, like, prostitutes on 97th Street, or probably 118th Avenue, perhaps, as well. But, you know, why do that? I'm pretty sure that you can make your own extrapolation. But the context cues. Okay. Now, there's another issue here to talk about a little bit as well, just to sort of finish up our stimulus control discussion. And that's an issue of conditional relations. So we've been talking a lot about these binary interactions, these binary relations. So in classical conditioning, this would be between two stimuli, a CS and a US. In operant, it's going to be between, say, an operant response and an outcome. So events, okay? We've got these binary relations between events. Now, we can also talk about what are called modulators. A modulator, then, is going to be a third event that determines the nature of the binary relationship. Basically, the modulator is an event that signals a conditional relation. It says, yeah, this is, you know, this is the condition that you're in. Now, in instrumental or operant conditioning, this is actually pretty obvious. What's the modulator? The modulator is the discriminative stimulus. Okay? So that one is, well, we've already done that. So in the presence of a discriminative stimulus, you make this response, you get this outcome. Okay, so that becomes the modulator. It modulates the behavior. What are you going to do? Well, in the presence of this stimulus, if in the presence of an S plus, if I make a response, I get reinforced. In the presence of the S minus, if I make a response, I either don't get reinforced or get reinforced less. In classical conditioning, though, this is perhaps a little less obvious. The modulators are not, in and of themselves, the CS plus or the CS minus. That's part of our binary relationship there. In classical conditioning, then, are what we call our modulators are what we call facilitators or occasion setters. Now, a way that you can set this up is, here's a simple little methodology. So our CS will be a noise, our US will be food, and the modulator will be a light. So if we have a light turned on and a noise gets presented, and if food follows, we've got a delay conditioning situation here. So here's our, you know, CS, here's our US. In the second situation, if the light's not on, but the noise is presented, there's not going to be food presented. Okay, so we've set up a training situation like this. The light itself is not a CS. It's an occasion setter. It says, in the presence of this stimulus, if you get the noise, then the noise is going to predict the occurrence of the food. In the absence of our modulator, our facilitator, our occasion setter, if you're presented with the noise, you will not get the food. So we're going to have situations like that. Okay. That was stimulus control. Right. Back to where I was about 15 minutes ago. Okay. When I last taught this course, back in 2002, Damien didn't actually have a chapter on extinction of conditioned behavior. His stuff on extinction was just worked into like chapter 6 or something like that. There's actually been a lot happening in the comparative psychology field with respect to extinction, theorizing about extinction, more complicated studies looking specifically at extinction. So there's been a lot happening over the last 10 or 15 years here. I guess Damien decided it really warranted then its own chapter. With respect to extinction, so a conditional stimulus occurring without the unconditional stimulus. Classical conditioning, that's going to be what produces extinction. So if we've gone through our acquisitions, CS paired with US, CS comes to predict the US. Now if we present the CS by itself, no US, extinction. In operant conditioning, response without the outcome. In both cases, We're going to get a decrease in response. In the case of classical, decrease in our conditional response. In the operant setting, the decrease in the actual operant response. Now, as you hopefully remember from 2A1, it's not simply just a reversal of acquisition. And if you think back to the Roscorla-Wagner equation, this is one of the problems with the Roscorla-Wagner equation. It treats extinction really just as a direct reversal of extinction. You just run the equation backwards. So instead of running towards a maximum associative strength, the lambda term of, you know, whatever, 50, you start at 50 and you run back to zero. Okay? So there's a problem there. But that being said, some of the ideas of the Roscorla-Wagner, that the sense that that the Roscorla-Wagner is structured around a difference between your expectation. So structured around the differences between the expectation of what's going to happen and what actually happens, that may, in fact, we call that an error correction function. So if your expectation and the outcome are exactly the same, no error that you have to correct. If there is a difference, then there's learning. So, in fact, in this sense, this error correction function of the Roscorla-Wagner actually fits nicely with extinction. Right? You expect that you're going to get, if you make this response, you will receive the reinforcer. You don't. Oh, you have to learn something. So even though Roscorla-Wagner actually, in terms of the way that you calculate amount of extinction or whatnot, has some problems with that, the underlying concept of error correction is actually perhaps quite spot on, as we'll see. So it's not just simply that we reverse our acquisition. It is definitely not the same thing as forgetting. That is an entirely different structure. Extinction really is you're learning something new. In essence, it's its own acquisition process. You are acquiring an inhibitory relationship. Now, extinction is extremely common in real life. And in fact, it's actually necessary. I mean, we often talk about extinction being problematic. It's like, oh, no, the response extinguished. Oh, I really wanted that response. Okay, but it's actually quite important, right? What if, I mean, you know, for the last five weeks, I guess, you've gotten used to coming to this class on Tuesday, Thursday at 1:30 after you write the final exam. If you keep coming here Tuesday and Thursday at 1:30, got a problem. I'm not going to be here. I'll probably, after this class is all wrapped up and I've been teaching the amount that I have, I'm going to just be getting a big old keg of beer. And after I'm done grading, people aren't going to see me for a while. It's just like, yeah, no. So no one will be here. Stop coming. Extinguish your response. But it's the context cue. It's the discriminative stimulus. This is where I'm supposed to. No, it's all done. Okay. As I said, extinction can be very important. So it's an adaptation to changing conditions. Or consider you've had some friend and you keep calling them and they stop returning your calls. Right? I mean, sooner or later, you're going to stop calling them. You will extinguish attempting to make contact with this person. And that's probably for the good. Otherwise, you may be like some sort of weird, scary stalker that gets a restraining order placed upon them. So, in some cases, extinction is very important, very beneficial. Okay, so there are certain, call it effects of extinction or likely outcomes of extinction. We see certain patterns fairly commonly. So, generally, you don't extinguish immediately. Okay, it may take a while for the extinction to occur, so you may continue to make the response for a while. I mean, while I doubt that you will keep coming to class after the course is done, if you happen to be on campus for, let's say you're here for summer session, and let's say that maybe you've got another course in a different room in this building, you may find yourself at some point, you know, turning into the wrong classroom. Oh, wrong classroom. And then go off and find the actual one. So, you know, the behavior may persist for a while. There could be, you know, very commonly an increase in the behavior. The rate of responding may actually increase for a period. Extinction bursts can occur. the behavior, you may vary the behavior. If this isn't working, I'll try something else. Pushing the button on the vending machine doesn't work. I'll start kicking the vending machine. That's not working. I'll try to rock the vending machine to shake my food out. Oh dear, I just got crushed to death. How unfortunate. So, you've got your friend, our hypothetical friend, that's no longer calling you anymore. Okay, so perhaps you increase your rate of phone calls from like maybe calling once a week to try to touch base. You now start phoning every day. You haven't phoned me back yet. I've left a lot of messages. Why won't you phone me back? You still haven't phoned me back. Why not? I just phoned you like an hour ago. What's going on? Those sorts of things? Yeah? Okay. You may, like, wait. Say, well, okay, the phone's not working. I'm just going to, like, hang out outside of my friend's workplace and wait for them to leave. I'll see them then. Heading towards scary stalker. Okay? But it's all just because of extinction effects. So when you get dragged before the judge with, you know, a restraining order, you can try to justify this. I'm sorry, it's just an extinction effect. It's to be expected. You can't blame me. That may or may not work. The judge may either go, you've got an excellent point, or they may go, being a wise ass, going to double your fine and put an even larger area that you can't come close to this person, you know. Restraining order not to come within 6 kilometers. Okay. So, hard to say. Leaving aside hypothetical stalking of people, Neuringer and colleagues in 2001 did a little study here. So, rats in operant chambers, we've got two levers and a key. The rats needed to make 3 responses in a row to receive food. In the first group, they had to vary the response pattern. They had to keep changing it. They had to keep mixing it up there. They couldn't just do the same thing. In the second group, no variation was required. They could do the same response each time in a row there. But they were yoked. They're our control group here. So they get as many reinforcers as... So each rat in group 2 is yoked with a rat in group 1. So if in the experimental session, you know, group 1 rat A manages to get 30 reinforcers, then group 2 rat A will get 30 reinforcers as well. Keep going until they acquire that. So they go through an acquisition phase of this, and then they put the groups onto extinction. So they acquire the behavior, then they eliminate it. And... Here's some results. So we find a few things. There's an increase in the variation in behavior in our group 1 rats, and we get a change in the response rate. So up here, probability of variation in responding. So let's see. The circles are black circles are variation reinforced. Open circles, variation, on extinction, and the black squares are the yoked reinforced and the yoked extinction. So basically over here, this is once they're onto extinction, over here we've got our variation subjects during reinforcement. So for our variation one here, we've got a high degree of variability in our variation group because that's what they get reinforced for. But notice, even when they're on extinction, this doesn't drop off. They keep trying, they keep trying different things. So they've got a training session, or acquisition session, then extinction, acquisition, extinction, okay? The open circles there, they pop up. We put them onto extinction. They just try different things. They're even more varied than they were before. The yoked group here, that shows us even better. Look at this. I mean, they're not being required to make varied responses. So when they're reinforced, they don't. As soon as they go onto extinction, it's a lot more variation. I don't know why I'm not getting reinforced. I'm just going to try something else. You know, I had a pattern that seemed to be working. I was responding in a way that was getting me reinforced. I'm just going to do something different. Let's see what happens. Anything? 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 Nothing? This sucks. Okay, so their actual variation increases. And we get a change in response rates here as well. Early on, the response rates in extinction are higher, then they drop off. Okay, so we see that fairly consistently. Now, another thing that happens in extinction is that we get actually an emotional component to it. Let's call it frustration. I mean, frustration in people versus, you know, frustration in a rat or a quail or a wallaby. I mean, you know, trying to assess whether or not that's exactly the same mood state, that's a bit difficult. Does it mean exactly the same thing? But there's certain behavioral responses that, you know, if you saw those in humans, you're, that's a pretty frustrated, you know, that would be a pretty frustrated person. That's got to be a pretty frustrated rat. So even if there may be some species differences in exactly what we mean by frustration here, even if you don't like giving emotional states to the non-humans, we'll call it, in literature, it's called frustration. So extinction produces frustration. There's an emotional reaction induced by the withdrawal, the withholding of an expected reinforcer, or if it's classical conditioning, the withholding of the unconditional stimulus. And this is perhaps what intensifies the behavior. Frustration causes things like corticosteroid release, amongst other things, that has an effect on aggression. Okay, so produces energy, sometimes it's directed aggression, sometimes it's undirected aggression. But very frequently, frustration and aggression go together. Many human studies demonstrate this. And in fact, we see something stunningly similar in the non-humans. A study by Tomy and colleagues from 93 worked with rats. They water deprived the rats, so the rats are thirsty. So they're trying to get water here. They alternate between 3 minutes of variable time, 30-second water delivery, and 3 minute no water extinction periods. And the extinction period is signified by a tone, so that would be our S minus. Okay, so in the presence of the tone, you will not be getting any water. In the presence of no tone, or in the absence of the tone, if you prefer, you get water on a variable time, 30 seconds. Now, they don't have to do anything to get the water, so they don't have to make any responses. there's a what we call a target bite bar that they included in the cage. When rats seem to get frustrated, they will just chew on things. Anyone kept little rodents as critters, as pets? Yeah, little mice, hamsters, whatnot. If you find your little critter chewing away on the bars frantically, it may be an indication of frustration. So you may need to give them something a little more stimulating in their environment. I am so freaking bored! I hated it here! You know, I started keeping rodents as pets. Something like, actually, back when the rodents had saber teeth, you know, it's like that long ago, like prehistoric rodents kind of thing. They're huge, too. No, a long time ago. And, you know, in the books on rodents back then, keeping rodents, housing rodents, it's like, well, that's just because their teeth continuously grow, so they have to chew on things to wear them down. Yes, that is true. They will chew on things like wood or hard food or things like that. If they're doing nothing but sitting, you know, in front of the bars, gnawing away at the bars, you've probably got a very frustrated rodent. There's something going on there. The caliber of life is not perhaps ideal for this little critter. Anyways, it's been recognized since, the 60s, like Azrin and colleagues from 68, demonstrated that biting at something is a consistent, very easily produced sign of frustration. In rats, it's really a species-specific behavioral output there. So you can, Azrin and colleagues did this by giving shocks to rats. So they'd shock the rat, and the rats would, after being shocked, go over and just bite things, chew on things. Didn't prevent them, didn't cause them to avoid getting shocked. It's just like zap. They chew away on stuff. Okay, so Tomi and colleagues are making use of that. So here's what we get. In the presence of the no tone here, relatively little biting. It's like, I'm getting water, I'm thirsty, I'm not that frustrated. Okay. So, pretty low. During the tone, I mean, look what happens here, right? Frustration is much higher, and actually as it goes on, it increases. So as they learn more and more that the S minus indicates they're not going to get water, they get more and more frustrated, and we get a general increase in the amount of biting. Okay. Azrin and colleagues in 66... same one that demonstrated target biting in rats, but in 66 did the study where worked with pigeons, at pigeons, and the pigeons were conditioned to peck a key for either food, or so they were on a food reinforcement period, or they were on extinction. So under periods, and they'd alternate back and forth between being able to get food or not. Now, they did something a little bit different. What they had was a restrained pigeon in the cage as well, or in some conditions they had a stuffed pigeon, a model of a stuffed pigeon in there. The restrained pigeon couldn't eat the food, couldn't actually move around, couldn't do terribly much of anything. It was just kind of sitting there. Matter of fact, it was restrained. So here's our experimental subject. Here we got a response key. Here's the little aperture he sticks its head into to get the food. And, you know, here's the restraining box with our second pigeon stuck in it. And it can't do anything, really, right? It can't get out of this little box. There's a little top shield, a little side shield, bottom here. Just its head is sitting there. And what happens to this poor little bugger is it becomes sort of the brunt of the other pigeon's frustration. And so this pigeon will go over and just start pecking at this other one. To be fair, as soon as this pigeon starts getting sort of attacked, it'll like start pecking back. Ever heard of pecking order before? Actually comes from chickens. Chickens actually develop social hierarchy, and they will literally like peck other chickens to death. Was like tear them apart with their beaks, and in fact, at some points in the study, they had to actually stop the experiment with some of the subjects because they were getting badly hurt. Either the experimental subject was hurting the restrained pigeon, or the restrained pigeon was like kicking the other one's ass. Like, oh yeah, you're gonna peck me? Oh yeah, I'm gonna come back and peck you even harder. Oh, I can't move, but you got to come close enough to me to peck me. So, oh yeah, I'm bam. Yeah, how do you like that? Huh? It's like okay. So they eventually moved to, it's like, yeah, we should get a model of a pigeon. Let's get a stuffed pigeon, right? Let's just get a toy pigeon. Let's stick that in there, okay? Let's see what's happening. Okay. It turns out that works fine, too. Okay, so this is the design. So here's their attack behavior. So cumulative records for just three of their pigeons here. The pin steps up for every second of attack directed towards the restrained pigeon there. And so these little sort of heavy black dots indicate when there was continuous food reinforcement, when the pigeon can get food. And so, you know, what we see happening here is, you know, when food is not available, the pigeon runs over and starts taking its frustration out on the other pigeon by pecking away at it. You did this! You made the food go away! Well, we're not exactly sure if the experimental pigeon is blaming the other pigeon. But if anybody that's kept pigeons or, you know, chickens knows that they will fight each other for food. If you just throw a bunch of grain down in an enclosure with pigeons, they will start pecking at each other to try to drive other pigeons away from the grain. It's like, oh yeah, get too close to my mouth, I'm going to peck you. Okay, it's kind of like, you know, with dogs. Some dogs are fine. Some dogs you can just, like, take the food away from. Other dogs, it's like, yeah, he's eating, leave him alone. You don't want to go near his head. Okay? So, could get bit. It's like, ah, don't take my food. Okay, so pigeons will do this. And so in all of these pigeons here, we see, you know, shortly afterward, once the food goes on to extinction, like in these ones down here, we get a very, very distinct for a little while there. It's very frustrating. Take out the frustration on the other pigeon, then it more or less stop. Then get some more food. Ah, stops. They get frustrated. Okay. The length of the attacks. So these are showing the average duration of the attack after the termination of the food for different pigeons. Very high early on, but as time passes, the frustration seems to die off, and the pecking behavior, the aggressive behavior, decreases as well. So we get a standard sort of extinction curve on that. Now, as I said, eventually they found that this was getting kind of vicious, and so they shifted to using a stuffed pigeon as a model, and it worked really nicely, actually. They found stunningly similar behavior. It didn't really matter terribly much to the experimental pigeon whether or not it was a real pigeon or a model of a pigeon. They just really had to go peck at something. Now, this has some very interesting considerations for human behavior. So if you've got humans that get, perhaps, say, males, that get frustrated by something, and they're looking for something to take their aggression out on, they may punch their spouse or hit their spouse. But if there was a model, something else that they could punch, a punching bag, something like that, that might work just as well. Might be a very simple way of reducing the aggression directed. Get them a membership to a gym. Some people that get frustrated, they're stressed by things. They're like, I just got to go running. I have to go run. I'm going to be back about 3 hours. Okay. Whatever it happens to be. Okay, or I got to go to the gym. Or I got to go box. Or whatever it is. So, you know, interesting implications for certain human behavior systems here. Doesn't need to be a real pigeon. Wouldn't necessarily need to be, you know, so if you get frustrated with your professor, hopefully not me, but other professors, right? Don't go, you know, beat up your professor. Just make a model of your professor and beat the stuffins out of it or stick pins in it, you know, whatever your inclination is. They looked at issues with the number of food deliveries and what effect that had on the amount of aggression due to frustration. So they used 0, 1, 3, 5, 10, or 30 deliveries of food before they shifted to extinction. Now, again, they were working with the stuffed pigeon at this point, not a real pigeon, but they found a positive correlation in between the amount of food and the attack duration. Down here, so 0, 1, 3, 5, 10, 1, 3, 5, 10, 15, and 30. What we see here is the seems to flatline out around the 10 to 15 pieces of food. There may be a satiation effect going on there, but the greater the amount of reinforcement, the more frustration was involved when they switched to extinction. Keep that in the back of your mind. We're going to come back to that at the end of the class when we talk. When we get to the section on theory of extinction. So we'll talk about behavioral momentum. So the amount of reinforcement is going to be important there. So we see that very nicely in these examples here. Means there's, you know, so this kind of work actually, you know, beautifully done in the 60s here. It produced some rather serious implications for therapy, for behavioral therapy. It's pointing out that because a lot of therapy that was being tried at the time was simply just extinction based. It's like you want to quit some behavior, stop some behavior. We're just going to prevent you from getting access to whatever it is, stop you from doing it, essentially put you on to extinction. Here's try and quit smoking. Here's a bunch of cigarettes with no nicotine in them, things like that. Now, extinction then acts as an aversive outcome. So extinction is aversive. Aversives create frustration. Frustration produces aggression. I feel like Yoda, right? Out of this, fear leads to anger. Anger leads to whatever, violence, and violence leads to crappy movies. Because, whatever Yoda was saying in that little line. But still, so extinction is aversive. Aversive events create frustration. Frustration produces aggressive behavior. And this could be directed towards the therapist, which may be appropriate because the therapist is the one putting, the individual on extinction. Hopefully not, but still. Anyone that's in close proximity, spouse, children, pet dog, random bystanders, could, co-workers. Could take your frustration and anger out on them. It may not be physical. You may not be just walking around beating up staff in at your place of work, but you may be snippy or harsh or insulting or rude or, things like that. Could be directed towards the self as well. Okay. So this had very significant implications in therapy, and it sort of explains why some of the behavior analyst therapeutic approaches we're finding, this is a problem. Why is it that we're getting so much aggression here? This seems peculiar. It's like, right. Well, we'll come back to some issues about that and possible ways of reducing the extinction effects in a little while. All right, so extinction and original learning. What's actually happening there? Well, as I said, it's not a reversal. You're not just reversing what you've learned before. You're not forgetting what you've learned before. You can have forgetting effect. I mean, extinction and forgetting can both be happening at the same time, obviously. They're completely separate processes. So, I mean, neurologically, if you're just forgetting stuff, that can make what looks to be an extinction effect even more marked, but they're really then two separate processes going on at the same time. So extinction really just is an acquisition of new learning. You are acquiring something else. You've learned during your first acquisition phase. The CS is paired with the US. CS predicts US. Your next acquisition phase, which we'll call the extinction phase, is CS no longer predicts US, but it used to. Now, an interesting little thing called disinhibition. In disinhibition, you fully condition your conditional stimulus with your US. So you have your full acquisition phase there. So you get a nice, strong conditional response. Then you impose your extinction protocol. So you extinguish the CS until we have no conditional response. Then you present a novel stimulus along with your extinguished CS. And lo and behold, you get a reoccurrence of the CR. So the CR comes back. Right? Now, why is it called disinhibition? It actually goes back to Pavlov. Pavlov discovered this, Pavlov named it, and Pavlov worked it into his entire theoretical account of classical conditioning. And Pavlov's interpretations of classical conditioning were very physiologically driven, as we've discussed, involved excitatory and inhibitory sections of the brain. He was wrong, but, we still use the basic, wrong in terms of his physiological accounts of it, but more broadly, the idea of excitation and inhibition seems to be not too far off. So Pavlov said, excitatory conditioning produces an increase in the excitatory strength. Okay, good. So far, so good. What does extinction do? Well, extinction then is an inhibition of the excitatory conditioning. Now, essentially, it's an opponent process system. Yet another one. It says the behavior you get, your conditional response, the outcome, is going to be the net sum effect of, say, your CS plus and the inhibition due to extinction. So by the time that we have got, we've gone through our acquisition, we've got a lot of excitation, then we go through our extinction, we now have inhibition. So once we've gotten to full extinction, our excitation is equally and oppositely matched by the inhibition caused by the extinction, so we get zero. So 10 units of excitation plus minus 10 units of inhibition gives zero or no conditional response. So we've got a disinhibition, or so we've got the inhibition component there. Now, the disinhibition stimulus inhibits the extinction inhibition. So we inhibit the inhibition. So you've got a negative number, right? So x minus y. Remember your math? X minus minus y, x plus y. Okay. The negative of a negative is a positive. Whoa. Yeah, I know. It's bizarre. Okay. Math is so weird. Can't you just give me a rat? I think I can actually, figure that out easier. Okay. Anyways. But this is the idea. So the inhibition stimulus inhibits the inhibition from extinction. And as such, it temporarily reduces the extinction inhibition component. So now we've got our excitation. That hasn't been touched. Extinction doesn't take away the initial excitation, according to Pavlov. Still in there. It adds the inhibition from extinction. But there's this disinhibition component, which counters this. So now we get something greater than zero. We get a little temporary return. The disinhibition doesn't last very long, though. Kind of like in habituation sensitization effects, it wears off relatively quickly. So very quickly, after a few more presentations of your disinhibition stimulus, your novel stimulus with the CS that you've extinguished, it will stop producing the conditional response. Okay, so disinhibition is a temporary effect there. This parallels actually very nicely the concept we did talk about earlier was dishabituation, right? So in habituation, dishabituation is the temporary return of a habituated response without the rest period. And there's various ways of doing this in habituation. We could present a new stimulus along with the habituated stimulus. So we've habituated the stimulus, and then we present a new stimulus along with it. We get a little bit of return of the behavior. We could change the habituated stimulus. Fisher did this with the Coolidge effect. You heard of the Coolidge effect? Biologists loved it. Yeah. The story goes as follows. So President Coolidge was visiting with his wife a chicken farm, and Coolidge was what, back in the 1880s or something like that. One of the largely forgotten presidents, except for this, as it turns out. So they're doing one of these, meet and greet things where they're visiting someone's chicken farm, and Mrs. The farmer is proudly showing off his roosters and his hens and whatnot, and talks about how hard working the roosters are. And Mrs. Coolidge says, how many times a day is the rooster expected to perform his male duties? And the farmer says, well, many times a day, Mrs. President, he performs that very frequently. In other words, he's supposed to have sex a lot. And she says, oh, you should make sure you tell President Coolidge that. President Coolidge overhears this and says, tell me, sir, is the rooster always performing his male masculine duties with the same hen or with different hens? Oh, no, sir, it's with different hens. Ah, you should tell that to Mrs. Coolidge. So, this is the Coolidge effect, then. In terms of sexual behavior, a male rat will habituate with the female, initially will try to mate with her frequently. After he's been in her presence for a while, he will stop mating with her, present a new novel female. Suddenly, he's back to trying to mate. So, in other words, you change the habituated stimulus, you can get a return. And you could also change the context in which the habituation is being produced, so change the contextual stimuli as well. So, as I said, the disinhibition process, very similar in respects here to dishabituation. Now, in the case of dishabituation, we talk about a temporary sensitization process that's superimposed on our habituation process. In disinhibition, we've got a temporary disinhibition component that cancels out some of the extinction inhibition. It doesn't last very long. All right. And again, that demonstrates that the conditioning has not been lost. Extinction doesn't eliminate what you originally learned. If it did, there would be no return when you present a novel stimulus. All right. Spontaneous recovery also shows this. In classical conditioning, we have spontaneous recovery. When we fully condition a CS-US pairing, then we fully extinguish the CS, then we just let some time pass. Okay, just wait for a while, come back in a few days, hours, days, whatnot. Present the conditional stimulus again, and you'll get a return of the conditional response. Probably not a full strength conditional response return, but you'll get at least some conditional response coming back. So that's our classical conditioning, spontaneous recovery. Rescorla recently, demonstrated this a long time ago, but you know, here's a more recent look at this. Used goal tracking for two different conditional stimuli. Went to full conditioning for all of the groups, followed by full extinction. So we'll see we call a CS rest group. So these are ones where the test session was after 8 days of resting. So 8 days after the end of the extinction process, and the CS no rest. In that case, they tested basically immediately after extinction. And then there's a pre-CS group. This is just the control group. It's never had any of the extinction at all. So that's just our control. So this is what we find. The open squares are your CS rest, the ones we're looking for spontaneous recovery in. The open circles are the CS no rest, and the triangles here are the pre-CS. So pre-CS down very low here are no rest, gets the presentation of the CS right after extinction. In essence, just another extinction trial, right? Just presented with the CS again, nothing happens. But look it up here, the CS rest group. First time, you know, after 8 days out of extinction, 8 days after going through the full extinction process, get presented with the CS, boom. Get a return of the response, and then it drops off again. Okay, so when this happens, spontaneous recovery doesn't last all that long, right? And again, it's a temporary return of the response. But again, it shows that extinction doesn't eliminate the earlier learning. In operant conditioning, we can have a spontaneous recovery as well. So we condition up our three-term contingency, discriminative stimulus, response, outcome, extinguish the response, allow some time to pass, and then present the discriminative stimulus. And in the presence of the discriminative stimulus, we then get some return of the responding. So the subject makes the responses again. Another Rescorla. You know, for a guy that was doing, you know, burst onto the scenes in the 60s with a bunch of pivotal papers and had the Rescorla-Wagner equation from the late 60s, early 70s, He hasn't really slowed down terribly much. Active through the 90s. He's still publishing by, today, 21st century. So he's had a very long and active career. Makes me look really bad, actually. So, embarrassing. 96 study by Riscorla worked with rats. Either would press a lever or do a nose poke. Rats like sticking their noses in holes. They will. It's species kind of thing. They sometimes probably a look for food. Stick their nose in, sniff a bit. Is there some food in there? If there is, they'll try to claw at it and get to where the food is. Back in 281, in Psych 281, if you took that course with me, I talked about the hero rats. These are rats, Gambian pouched rats that are used to look for landmines or tuberculosis. And they actually take advantage of this because when they do the tuberculosis test, they have the little petri dish of the saliva sample that may or may not have tuberculosis in it. They put it under a little tiny hole, and the rat just sticks its nose down in the hole. So they don't even have to really shape the rat too terribly much to stick its nose in a hole, because rats do this when looking for food. So it's actually a very easy way. Why are they doing it that way? It's kind of an odd way. Why not have something up on the wall or something like that, a little scent patch or something like that? It's just because it's really simple. They'll just stick their nose. You give a rat a hole, he's going to poke his nose in it and sniff and see what's in there. So lever press or nose poke. So they condition these up. So they go through the acquisition. Then they extinguish them. Then we've got the rest. The one group that's for resting, they get 7 days off after the last extinction trial, and then they're presented with a response. The second group is tested pretty much right after extinction. And again, we see a similar kind of pattern here. So spontaneous recovery shows up in our rest, our group that's rested, first early on after the stimulus is presented again. Stimulus is presented. We see a fairly high rate of responding here compared to our extinguished no rest group, and then it drops back down. And look, it doesn't take very long before basically they're back to an extinction level of responding. 4 minutes or something like that. Okay, so spontaneous recovery. Again, this shows that we haven't eliminated the learning through extinction. Renewal also demonstrates this. Renewal is the recovery of the acquisition of performance when context cues that were present during extinction are changed. So thank you for reminding me to do chapter 8 at the end there, because, we were talking about context cues. It would have been kind of embarrassing if I'd gotten to this point. It's just like we just talked about the... Oh, yeah, we did. So, we learn about our context cues. These context cues, we associate them with things, even if we're not immediately aware that we're doing this. They perhaps take on a particular meaning. And so during extinction, there will as well be contextual cues that go along with the extinction. It says, yes, we are in the extinction situation. Now, if you then change those cues, if you make them different, it's like, oh, wait, the cues, the stimuli that indicate that I should be on extinction are no longer here. Perhaps I'm not on extinction anymore. If you, in fact, even bring them, what this suggests then, again, renewal suggests that in the case of, say, operant conditioning, extinction is just learning another three-term contingency. In the presence of these particular context cues, which act as a discriminative stimulus, if you make a response, you will get nothing. You will be sad and frustrated, but you won't get the reinforcer. Okay, so those cues come to be important. Just stimulus control, in essence. Booten and King looked at this in 83. They had rats that would press a lever for food. They would pair a tone with foot shock. Essentially, this is just a condition suppression study. right? So operantly train rats to respond until they get to a steady state of responding, then produce a stimulus that indicates something aversive is going to happen, then present the aversive stimulus, the stimulus that indicates the aversive, in the presence of the lever pressing response, and see whether or not we get conditioned suppression. So they've got training in two chambers, the original chamber and a novel chamber. So after training, so they go through their initial initial training of our initial training here. Then they have their 20 extinction trials, and then they're tested. Group one is tested in their original original chamber. All groups are tested in the original chamber at the end. The difference is where they go through their extinction. Okay, so they're all trained initially in the original chamber, and then group one gets its extinction trials in the original chamber, chamber A. Group two gets the extinction trials in chamber B. So in group one, the tone is paired, the tone is presented in chamber A, and nothing happens, no shock. So we extinguish the tone. In group two, they're in a different chamber, chamber they've never been in before. The tone goes through extinction. And group three is just a control. They had no extinction process at all. Then you put all of the rats back into the original chamber, the original training and testing chamber, the pre-extinction chamber, chamber A, and you see what happens. So we get this. So for, let's see, the, right, the black dots are extinction in chamber A, and the open circles are extinction in chamber B, and this one here is the no extinction, so they're just the control. So across extinction blocks here, we find that the suppression ratio increases. In other words, the responding is becoming less and less suppressed. Initially, early on, you present the tone, very suppressed, right? We don't get the responding. As extinction proceeds, the rats go back to responding. We're up pretty close to 0.5. 0.5 in the suppression ratio means the response is not being suppressed. Here's the extinction A. These are the rats that were extinguished in chamber A, and they're tested in chamber A. The rats that were extinguished in chamber B, look, they extinguished the responding. But we bring them back to chamber A and test them. Look at this. Suddenly, their responses are suppressed. They go from, you know, being pretty well extinguished here back down to, whoa, big fear response. They're afraid in chamber A. Well, it's suggesting that they've associated the extinction only with being in the presence of chamber B. Chamber B says, this is the discriminative stimulus. Chamber B, the context cues, in the presence of chamber B, the tone does not indicate a shock anymore. Well, what about in the presence of chamber A? Yeah, apparently, you still think there's going to be a shock there. Now, re-extinguishes relatively rapidly, but at least early on, says, yeah, I'm expecting to be shocked here. Suppressed responding. And here's our non-extinction non-extinction group. So the first test response in chamber A, it's just like they're doing, these are their first extinction trials. And so we start to see this group extinguishing, just like over here. Okay. So we see renewal in a number of contexts. We see it in classical appetitive conditioning. It's been demonstrated there. Experiments have shown it in cases of conditioned ambition, a variety of instrumental conditioning settings. It's even been shown to occur with like physiological states, so state-dependent learning. So you put a subject into a particular physiological state, for example, by giving them a particular drug, and then put them through extinction, and the extinction works great as long as they're back in that particular state, but if they're in a different physiological state, it may not have an effect. So Boutin, colleagues did this back in 1990. So you have to go through the whole extinction in that setting. Now, this has a lot of implications for therapy as well. So if you got someone who goes to a therapist for to extinguish some behavior, so through just, for example, exposure therapy, and if all the exposure therapy is done in the therapist's office, what happens when the subject leaves and goes out into the real world? Well, the office becomes the context cues for extinction, but the person's home doesn't have those same context cues, or their place of work, or anywhere else. But as long as you're in a therapist's office, oh yeah, you don't have that phobia anymore. So this is an issue. And in fact, therapists recognize this. It's not like I'm going, gee, I'm so smart and therapists are so dumb. No, therapists recognize it. And in fact, they may start working in the office, but for many cases where they're using exposure therapy, they will try to do the exposure therapy in a wide range of locations. When Carolyn was here with her dog for training helper dogs, again, it's a very important situation. For example, you may be trying to extinguish fear of strangers. Dogs get nervous around people they don't know, right? There's their people that they know and trust, and there's other people. You know, that's a different pack. You know, they may be dangerous. So you don't want that in a helper dog. You don't want the helper dog getting all sort of, oh, edgy and frustrated around people. That's never right. So you just take them everywhere. So when she's working helper dogs, she'll just drag the helper dog with her, you know, put a vest on the dog. It's not a helper dog yet. It's a helper dog in training, so slap the vest on it and take it with her out when she goes grocery shopping or, you know, to a bookstore or wherever. Just lots of different contexts, you know. Go on the LRT with the dog, ride around in a car, walk down quiet back alleys next to really busy highways. Just try to give lots of different contexts. Okay? So kind of an important issue. Reinstatement is the recovery of, say, excitatory responding by to an extinguished stimulus by producing by presenting an unconditional stimulus. So the response that was extinguished comes back when we present you with the unconditional stimulus again. So, for example, you got a fear of flying. You acquired this perhaps as a child because, I don't know, your father was a aeronautics daredevil that, you know, would do air shows and takes you up sometimes as a child and he's like spinning around, flying all over the place, and it terrifies you. So you're afraid of flying. As an adult, you go and you get extinction. You extinguish your fear through therapy. Then you have... if we were dealing with an issue of renewal here, you know, if you extinguish your fear in the office, as soon as you step on the plane, you're probably going to be afraid again. But we're dealing with an issue of reinstatement. So you're on a plane, everything's good, you're doing fine, no problems, until, you know, on one plane trip, something aversive happens. You have a single frightening flying experience, and the phobia can be reestablished in sort of one trial back to its pre-extinguished levels. So it's not a gradual reacquisition. You go straight back to the pre-extinction or pretty close to those pre-extinction levels. So the excitatory state that was extinguished is reinstated or reestablished. Boutin showed this in a non-real-world setting, so rats in a box. So we've got conditioned suppression in rats. Our U.S. is a shock. Your textbook's got a slightly different table in terms of doing this here. So our conditional stimulus leads to a weak U.S. So phase one, we've got four groups here. So CS goes to weak U.S., produces a weak UR. CS, weak US, weak Europe. And then second, or groups 3 and 4, CS strong, followed by strong US, strong conditional response. Okay. The reason they're using a weak US and a strong US is because then after we extinguish the strong, after we have the extinction protocol here, we'll end up with comparable conditional responses. So it's a comparative test. So in the our first groups here, the ones that get CS with the weak US, no treatment, consequently no extinction, consequently they've still got a weak conditional response. Our second group here that are getting the strong, CS pair strong US goes through extinction until we get down to a weak conditional response. We go through a reinstatement process. So each group, half of them, end up in the same context. half end up in as a different context. So same context as during training. The others end up in a different context, same or different. And what we find here is that those subjects that were in the same, well, in this case here, the CS is a weak CR, because that's all we ever had. So these are just really our controls. The interesting one is down, is going to be down in here. We're back into the same context. Essentially, we've got the same context cues indicating, a US there. We come back with a strong conditional response. With the different context, we're not reactivating this. So, in fact, Bolton actually suggests, and he's not everyone agrees with him on this. Bolton's actually arguing that reinstatement may really just be a subset of renewal. His argument here is that the U.S., again, comes along probably with particular contextual stimuli, and you come to, obviously, you pair, whatever your obvious CS is with the U.S., but there's specific stuff happening just with the U.S. as well. Consider, consider, say, short delay conditioning, okay, classical conditioning. So CS is presented. We present the classical, the conditional stimulus for 10 seconds, and then we terminate the CS and present the US. Okay? Maybe the CS and US overlap by 1 second, and then the US continues on for another 4 or 5 seconds on its own. Now, you say, okay, so we pair the CS with the US. CS leads to US. But look, when the US is being presented, sure, it overlaps a little bit with their CS here. But for most of the time the US is being presented, the CS isn't going on. So there's other stimuli that may get associated as well with the U.S. that just go, yeah, when there's only the U.S., not predictive, it's not predicting, right, more of a simultaneous conditioning. So there's other context cues that get simultaneously conditioned with the unconditional stimulus. Now, in terms of classical conditioning, simultaneous conditioning sucks in terms of, being a good way to produce a conditional response because it's non-predictive. It's like, thanks for letting me know, but I've already got the unconditional stimulus, lovely, not much use there, yeah. Okay? But in this case here, in these rather, esoteric sort of things now that we're getting into extinction, it could be, again, that during these, during the process where you're conditioning, it may be that even though these simultaneously conditioned context cues that go with the US don't produce conditional responses, doesn't mean that they're not encoded. Our brains actually store a context with the US. Consequently, the context cue activate this association with the US. Not everybody agrees with Bolton on this one, but since Bolton was one of the first people to really start looking at renewal and reinstatement, it's like, well, he's been thinking about this for 20 years. He's maybe got some insight on this. Okay, sensitivity to unconditional stimulus devaluation. So, we talked earlier, back when we talked about theory of operant conditioning, is it a SR connection, an RO, is it an SRO, these sorts of things. We talked about using devaluation to assess, so we could devalue various reinforcers, or we can do this in classical conditioning as well, devalue an unconditional stimulus. Basically, you take some stimulus and you make it aversive. So if before you were getting, make the response, get some food, and the food is yummy, now we'll make the food aversive by making you nauseous when you have the food. So induce, say, a taste aversion, or at least a feeling of nausea that goes with it. Devalues, or satiation. It's like food was very appealing, but you've eaten so much of it, you just can't eat anymore now. That's nice if you do it that way, because it's non-permanent, so you, not it's not as permanent. It's not as permanent. There we go. About 3 hours of sleep last night. Sorry. If it was unfortunate, I couldn't get you the lecture posted until, you know, whatever it was, 3 in the morning. Yeah, it was even more unfortunate for me that I was up until then writing it. So consequently, I can't talk tonight or today. I'd best just keep my mouth shut if I see Bandura this evening. Huh? Yeah, great. Won't go well tonight, so I'm just going to stay quiet and sit in the back, I think. Anyways, so we've talked about devaluing reinforcers or unconditional stimuli. And we can utilize this here as well in studies of extinction. So we can devalue an unconditional stimulus to see whether or not the initial CS-US association persisted through the extinction process. So we go through extinction, and then we'll devalue the US, and we'll see what happens. Studies that have done this, there's a number of studies that looked at this, to sort of, you know, ruin the anticipation, just cut straight to the chase. What these demonstrate is that stimulus response in classical conditioning and, in operant conditioning, no, sorry, classical conditioning, stimulus response and response outcome in operant, these associations get maintained after extinction. So here's a design that we can use. Your textbook gives you this design in a slightly different way. I'm just going to present it this way here, but you'll find the same basic concept there in the text. So let's say we've got two conditional stimuli, a light and a tone, and two different unconditional stimuli, food and sucrose. In an actual methodology, we would need to have a whole bunch, we'd have to have additional groups that were counterbalancing. Okay, so I'm just simplifying this down here to get you to the sort of important point. But in a real, if we're really running this, we'd have to have at least four groups who are counterbalancing everything. And that's the way your textbook describes it in terms of, so you have, you know, the two CSs. So CS1 would go with CS, or with US1, or two CS, you know, two would go with yada, 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 yada. So we'll just take a slightly simplified description here of this. Okay, so we would have to counterbalance this, though, in an actual methodology. We're going to use lithium chloride to devalue our unconditional stimulus, our food. In this case, we'll just use food. Now, again, in a real study, we need to also have groups where we devalued the sucrose. Okay, so you'd have to have more groups here. So that's the plan. Now, when we extinguish, they say, okay, so what we're going to do here is we're going to go through acquisition in phase one. So light paired with food, tone paired with sucrose. Phase two, for our first group of subjects, we would then extinguish the light and the tone. So extinguish light, extinguish tone. Second group, we're not going to do that, so no extinction here. Phase three, we'll just devalue, let's say, the food. So not the sucrose in this case. We devalue the food, and then we'd need to test the light and test the tone and see what the responding is. Now, what you would have to do in actuality is there actually needs to be another little phase in here. And in this phase, sort of phase 2.5, after you've extinguished your light and your tone with respect to food and sucrose, you need to recondition it to a third unconditional stimulus. Otherwise, when you test it, it's like it's already due. It's already extinguished, right? You're not going to get anything at all. You know, if it's already extinguished, if you're not going to make the conditioned response after you've devalued the food, you're still not going to make any conditioned response to either the food or the sucrose. So what we have to do is we have to recondition it. Now down here in our control, where there hasn't been an extinction, no problem. Okay, they haven't gone through an extinction phase. Come back, little mouse. There we go. So no extinction down here for this group. So we devalued the food. So if light was associated with food, we'd expect that we're not going to get responding. Our conditioned response is going to go for the light there. Okay. So there's our control. But to have anything happen over here, we have to actually, just for our first group, do a little reconditioning of both our light and our tone with different unconditioned stimulus so that we have something that we can actually measure as a conditioned response. Okay, so if we do this, then we get something kind of like this. So in my example here, the green is the light, the red is the tone, or if you prefer, the green is the not devalued condition, and the red is the devalued. So we might see things like this in our extinguished group and our not extinguished group, the strength of the conditioned response. Now remember, in the not extinguished group then, there's been group 2 down here, the only reduction in the conditional response strength is going to be due to the lithium chloride, the devaluation of the food. And remember, your food, did I get that backwards? Not devalued? Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. I got this backwards. That's what I get. Okay. Right. Make the green. Yes. Make the green the tone. Fix this quickly. Good, Michael. And the red. There we go. Okay. Right. Okay. Fix. Okay. okay. So the tone was paired with sucrose. So we haven't done any devaluation there. We've devalued the food. The food was paired with light. So in our non-extinguished group, the only reduction is going to be due to the devaluation of the food. And so we see a bit of a reduction here in the conditioned response. In this group here, now we've gone through extinction, so everything's going to be a bit lower. We had to recondition to something else. Okay, so we had to recondition. We've extinguished both light and tone. Okay. Then we reconditioned it to some other unconditional stimulus that's never been devalued. Take a look. Then what we still get here is, even though it's been reconditioned to something else, so we've extinguished these initially, we've extinguished the association, okay, then we recondition, we set up a new conditional response to some other US. If extinction was eliminating all of our prior learning, we shouldn't get this overall suppression here. Okay, so our extinguished group shows a weaker CR, and again, within the group, both of them are showing the stronger or the stronger response to the non-devalued stimulus. But if the extinction was having no effect, right, and it's because we've gone through a reconditioning phase here, these should really be the same. We shouldn't have a difference really between them. Okay, so but we do. other ways we can do this, if we want to do this in an operant conditioning setting, not a classical, we just need to set up with different responses and different outcomes. So phase one, we've got response one goes with outcome one, response two with outcome two, response three with outcome one, and response four with outcome two. Phase two, we extinguish. Response one gets extinguished. Response two gets extinguished. Response for three and four do not go through an extinction phase, so we've got our controls. Then we devalue outcome one with lithium chloride. So for all of the groups here, And then we test. So would you respond more to response 1 or response 2? And what about response 3 and response 4? So we do this here. So all the rats get these training. Different responses lead to outcomes. We take two of the groups, extinguish one response each, devalue one of our two outcomes, and then test which of the pairs is preferred. Oh, and again here, in our extinction groups, we have to, again, to get any sort of response out of this, anything we can actually measure, we have to recondition our response 1 and response 2 to a new outcome. Okay. And so over here, we get this. Oops. So again, our extinguished group overall, we see less responding, no surprise there. And in this case here, though, again, it's the devalued outcome that is not preferred. So coming back to this, up here, response 1 was paired with the devalued outcome. Then when you're given a choice between 1 or 2, preferentially respond to 2. Okay, response 3 and 4, again, in this case down here, response 3 was paired with the devalued outcome 1. Given the choice, go with response 4. Okay, so this is saying that we can associate the extinction, or the extinction process can work in different ways. So, and our devaluation can go back to specific response outcome associations. It's not going to affect everything broadly across the board. So what we're seeing here is we can have, you know, we've talked before how we can have a stimulus response, stimulus outcome, response outcome associations, or the stimulus bracket response outcome associations. So what we're seeing here is that extinction is not just operating in a blanket sort of way. We're getting very specific effects on these underlying associations. And again, this is the kind of stuff that's only really been coming out over the last 10, 15 years, which I think is why there's a new chapter in the book about this. Okay. Why don't we take a break here and come on back in 10, and we'll continue.